As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome to Copa with Felipe Cardenas. I'm your host. Today I'm joined by my friend and colleague, Sam Stashkul. He is the co-host of Allocation Disorder, you know him well, and a very respected U.S. men's national team reporter for The Athletic. Welcome, Sam. What's going on? Buenos dias.
Buenos dias, Felipe. I have my café. You have yours. We're ready to go. I'm excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yes, we're recording on Wednesday morning. So when we discussed this, we both agreed it's perfect time to have some coffee and talk soccer. Today, we're going to discuss the U.S. men's national team January camp. We'll get into the roster, not too deep. I know you covered that on Allocation Disorder last week, but we are recording today, Wednesday. Tonight is a big game for the U.S. men's national team against Serbia. Big game meaning just because, hey, it's the first game after the World Cup. A lot of opportunities.
Every game's a big game.
Every game is a big game, but here's why I wanted to bring you on, Sam, because yes, you know, January camp, it's not that exciting, but I feel like every game moving forward until the Greg Berhalter and Gio Reyna drama, fiasco, scandal is resolved, it's going to overshadow anything that happens on the field. So that's why I wanted to bring you on before we get into the actual roster of the U.S. men's national team and just talk briefly about Serbia. I'm going to introduce Colombia. I know them well. I do want to bring up a column that you wrote recently about the saga, and the title is In the U.S. Men's National Team's Berhalter Reyna Saga, Everyone Involved Faces Uncertain Future. I liked it a lot. It got over 300 comments. So clearly this is not an issue that is going away. I was thinking, like, if we were in a proper football country, I mean, this would be leading the news on every sports talk show, every sports center. But you know, it's not. We're in a different ecosystem. But you have a lot of expertise in this. So, like, what did you take away when writing this column? Like, how did you approach it, and why did you write it?
Well, I think it was why I wrote it. I just thought it was important to kind of lay it all out there, like on one coherent timeline, to sort of show in one place how poorly everybody here behaved. And I think that sort of helps put it in perspective a little bit. And that was my main motivation for writing it. And then I also wanted to spin forward a little bit and see what might be next for some of the parties involved. But, you know, I've talked about this before, Felipe, with you, with others in this piece on Allocation Disorder. So I'll keep it brief here, but it's just everybody did a bad job, basically. Everybody except Rosalind Berhalter, who is the only one that didn't do anything wrong. And she's the one that's having to suffer maybe the most. I don't know. I mean, that's not a competition, but she's the one that's suffering without having done anything wrong in the first place. Gio Reyna didn't try at the World Cup. How do you not try at the World Cup? Oh, that's ridiculous.
It's unbelievable. Yeah.
Greg Berhalter, obviously, you know, kicking his girlfriend, who is now his wife. That's a really bad thing that he did when he was 18 years old, 30 years ago. And then going after the World Cup to whatever leadership conference he went to in New York, and those comments were supposed to be off the record, and he never actually named Gio Reyna. But saying what he said, like, why? why are you doing that? What is the motivation? Like, you have to be smarter than that. And he wasn't. And then those get out. And then Claudio Reyna and Danielle Reyna calling Ernie Stewart and dropping this bomb. It's just kind of like, you know, what are you doing? Like that's so petty and vindictive and spiteful and out of proportion with what Greg Berhalter did. You were literally just looking, you know, in my opinion, it seems like they were literally just looking to get revenge because their son didn't play as much as they wanted him to at the World Cup. And by the way, Felipe, when he did play, he was not good. I think that bears mentioning as well.
Well, whatever he wasn't doing on the training pitch, he took onto the field during the games. He didn't look like he was engaged at all. Yeah. And he didn't make a difference. I mean, it's not to interrupt, but I you know Greg very well and having covered him for the last few years and through some really difficult like sporting moments for the national team during qualifying when we all thought they're going to lose this game. He's out. Are they overconfident? Are they overhyped? Is he experienced enough? You've been in countless press conferences with him. Was it really that surprising that in this sort of educational symposium that he's talking to, that he went off the cuff and he went too far? Did that surprise you at all?
No.
No, it didn't, right?
Maybe a little bit. I shouldn't say not at all, but like, no, it didn't surprise me because, you know, if you listen to like his podcast that he did on US Soccer, or if you just listen to his press conferences and availabilities, he's traditionally been very open.
Yeah.
And over time, I would say he became less open with the regular press corps and maybe he felt like he got burned a time or two. Or maybe the stakes just got higher as they got closer to the World Cup and he wanted to keep things closer to the best. But for whatever reason, he felt comfortable in this setting. You know, he's a guy that likes the leadership books. He pays attention to those things and maybe he felt the need to impress these people. I don't know what his motivations were. I just don't know what he would have gained apart from like telling a cool story to these people who, I don't know, maybe paid a lot of money to come hear him speak. Like,
yeah,
it's just, I mean, like, the why audience, do you need to sound impressive to this constituency? I don't get it.
But yeah,
it's something like that he seems to have tried to have done.
Yeah,
semi-consistently. Yeah.
That was my takeaway in front of this specific audience. It's like it's one thing to go off script, but also clearly to him, maybe this was something that he wanted to get off his chest, and it, you know, in this moment, it happened. Now, when I think of Gio Reyna, I go back to, I know during the cycle he was considered and really put on this pedestal as like the future of the national team, as one of the most talented players in this pool. Clearly, a very capable footballer. He's playing in Germany. He's playing for Borussia Dortmund. The quality is there. I think when I think of Gio Reyna, the quantity isn't, he hasn't played enough in order for us to really say this guy is indisputable and cannot be taken out of the lineup. But something that, and I know you know this, we've talked offline about this. I remember going back to 2019 when I was still reporting on just my own reporting about Tata Martino wanting the US job, when I was writing that big story for Atlanta United, and I was talking to just like different sources, and Gio Reyna came up because of the way he had behaved previously for youth national teams under different coaches. That then became part of this whole fiasco, this whole saga of Claudio Reyna reaching out to Rafael Wicki, at the time the youth national team coach. He had to admit that. And now it's like all coming full circle that perhaps we have a problem child, really, a player that's difficult to coach. You mentioned it before on your own podcast that this could affect Gio Reyna in the future, perhaps in where he goes beyond Borussia Dortmund. But I just think it says a lot about him, his own personality, and how he's been in this bubble with his own parents, protected all the time. Was it, knowing what you knew, was it really that surprising that Gio Reyna became a problem at the World Cup?
Yeah, I was surprised, certainly to the degree. I think it's natural for any player to be disappointed when they enter into a competition thinking, hey, I want to play, I might play. And then you're told you're not going to be the starter. Like, there's natural frustration and upset that comes with that. I don't begrudge him that whatsoever. I would never, him or anyone else. Yeah. But it's about how you respond to that adversity. And Gio Reyna didn't respond well. Like, he admitted that in the statement that he put out about this. Now, I think, to be fair, he's 20 years old. And is he the most, like, professional? Was this the most professional or mature that he could have acted? Of course not. But he's 20 years old. And, like, he has room to grow. Like, Felipe, I know you weren't a finished product when you were 20. Oof. I wasn't, you know? So, like, I think it's important to give him that grace and that ability to grow up a bit and learn from this. It's a shame that his parents followed it up by doing what they did. And that sort of compounds everything for me. Gio Reyna, we saw him the other day score a really nice goal.
I was going to bring that
Dortmund
up.
And then, yeah. And then, you know, put his fingers in his ears. It's a celebration. Block out the noise.
The goatee, the celebration, the anger. Like, I mean, he's not shying away from the controversy.
No, he's not. And that's fine. You know, like, this is how, like, if that's how he wants to respond, I don't have any issue with that. I think the important thing for him is that he needs to work. He needs to put his head down, not take anything for granted, and really try and capitalize on the immense talent that he does possess, because he is a super talented player. You see it when he's out there. And if he can stay healthy, and if he can kind of approach this with the right mindset of, I need to go out there and outwork everybody, then I think he'll go very, very far in his career. But it's a little bit of an inflection point too, because he has a choice to make. And is he going to go that road? Or is he going to go the road of, well, I was wronged here, and, you know, I'm the bee's knees, and I'm just going to feel like I've already earned it. And, you know, I think the early signs are very encouraging that he's going to go the correct route.
I mean, I think it's a bit of a cautionary tale with the way in U.S. soccer we're so obsessed with sending our youngest players to Europe as soon as they can. As soon as we see talent, get them out there. And there's a lot of positives to that. I guess what this is showing is that success, that early success, because let's face it, like, you know, he hasn't lifted a Champions League trophy or anything like that.
I mean, he's pretty well.
He's playing at, like, the highest level. Yeah. Like, if I were 20 years old playing at the highest level with a last name that is very well known.
If Erling Haaland was calling me the American dream.
I mean, I don't know how that doesn't go to your head, honestly. Like, I just cannot blame anyone for not being a little bit overconfident, somewhat, like, athletically arrogant. Great. Like, I respect all that. My question to you and what I've been thinking in my own head, even from what Berhalter said in that symposium, if we want to call it that. Is Gio Reyna a good teammate? I know it is. It's such an academic word, right? But is he a good teammate? You know, you mentioned it. He's extremely talented. That's where I'm going. We don't know, because I think someone like Tyler Adams, the captain of the U.S. team, is always going to be very professional, keep it close to the chest. But if he's not performing, not training hard, it becomes an issue. It becomes a dressing room issue where the players need to confront him. It's like a come to Jesus moment. Then the coach comes out and says what he says. To me, that's the big question for Gio Reyna moving forward. Can he be a good teammate?
Yep. And hopefully he can. This isn't written in stone. His story is not over. And like we said, he's 20. He's got a lot of potential to grow and mature as an individual and as a player. And hopefully he kind of keeps the edge on the field and maybe loses it a little bit in how he behaves interpersonally. Because, I mean, Felipe, like, was there another player at the World Cup that acted like this? There was one, I know. His name's Cristiano Ronaldo.
Well, that's part of the brand. And, like, I don't know, maybe he's,
but also Cristiano Ronaldo is one of the best players of all time.
Yeah.
And you saw what happened with Portugal when he was acting out of turn with his interview with Piers Morgan and kind of being a little bit of a brat at the World Cup. Like, his teammates, the body language, his coach, like, the benching, like, they sort of were like, enough of this, dude.
Yeah.
And so if you're going to behave like that, you have to be one of the best players, like, in the world. And Gio Reyna, for all of his talent, I mean, he's not that yet. That's no slight on him by any means.
No, he's not there yet.
But he hasn't, like, that's not where he's at. So until and unless he gets there, then maybe there should be an adjustment. And even if he does get there should probably be an adjustment, because no one wants to be around somebody that really acts that puts themselves above the team and the country and your friends and your peers at a World Cup.
Yeah. And like, I don't want to sound like the, I don't know, dad voice right now. Like, he needs to mature. But that's literally that's the easiest feedback that we could give a player at that age. And we saw, I remember you were there, you know, during the US game against Mexico at the Azteca after the game, the press conference, the giggling, the joking, the lack of respect, you know, shown towards the press corps that were there asking, like, you know, serious questions. This was a World Cup qualifier. It just, to me, I was a bit taken aback, like, okay, like, it's fine to have that personality. And they were happy, you know, a draw. It was a big draw for them against Mexico.
Yeah, it was a good result.
So I get it. But it did show, I think, it encapsulated what this team still is, a very young team. And I joked about it with Pablo Maurer on Copa last week, where it's like, well, this is what you wanted, a young team. This is what you get, where the parents are still involved in, like, the success, how they're viewed, how they're talked about. Look at Weston McKennie's dad, for all accounts and purposes, a cool guy. But like, he even slides into people's DMs, gets in on Twitter when people talk.
It's natural
down.
To want to protect your kid.
I get it. Like, I have kids. Maybe I wouldn't jump in on Twitter, but that's
but you would probably want to at certain points.
The world we live in. Yeah. That's the world. I mean, the other day, Nico was playing a basketball game, got fouled, pretty hard fouled by another 10-year-old.
Oh, yeah? Were you ready to throw?
I was ready to go down to, like, come on now. Come on. First of all, referee.
Were you going to fight a 9-year-old?
No, but I hear, like, it's something, I felt something in your being. So I get it. I just feel like this is part of the progression and the maturation of this team. This is all part of it. It's just very unfortunate. Now, Sam, part of this saga, as you called it in your column and in the titles, like, dominoes began to fall. Brian McBride, very accomplished national team striker in his day, is out as the U.S. men's national team general manager. Wasn't retained. Easy question. Like, what does that mean, and why did that happen? Is this part of this whole investigation?
We don't know. McBride's contract was up. So that's, you know, it wasn't like a firing necessarily. It's just like he just wasn't brought back.
To do what?
Claudio Reyna was texting him during the World Cup, along with Ernie Stewart, expressing his frustration about the lack of role that Gio Reyna had. So we don't know what McBride was texting back. Maybe that will come out in the investigation.
Sam, when we talk about there's like the other investigation, which was reported heavily by their outlets as, quote, potentially inappropriate communication and behavior from third parties towards U.S. staff.
So, yeah, that was in the U.S. soccer statement. I believe.
Right. Right.
So yeah, that could potentially play a role here. I'm not sure. The other thing I would say is that his job just sort of felt redundant.
Yeah, that's what I was like. What was he doing?
No one was ever really quite sure what he did. Like, Ernie Stewart was handling a lot of things on the men's side. Kate Markgraf is the GM on the women's side. She handles a lot of things on that end. McBride was ostensibly responsible for hiring and firing the head coach, but that was always Ernie Stewart's purview. You know, he was interfacing with club teams about, you know, availability and managing workloads, but Greg Berhalter did a lot of that. And it's just like, it might have just been a case of this position isn't really necessary.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't want to speculate too much, but it could be any number of things. But like, my gut feeling is that it's more along those lines than it would be under like any investigation or anything scandalous.
So let me read something from your column, because I think I found this interesting. You wrote, the ongoing investigation should also look into what the Federation knew about the incident when Berhalter was hired in December of 2018. The incident referring to what happened between him and his wife, Rosalind, in 1991. You write, at the time, Berhalter's brother, Jay, was a high-ranking executive at U.S. Soccer, though Stewart was most directly responsible for the hire. I thought that was interesting because it's like, as long as Berhalter's coach, that was always going to be out there. It was always of an easy way to critique the hire. Oh, his brother was part of the hiring process, the nepotism, all of that. But now it's when this comes to light, it's like we're going back in time and really thinking about the actual hiring process. What was known? What were things like slid under the, did they slide things under the carpet? Were they trying
to protect Greg? Like, Jay presumably knew about this.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like I would imagine, like Greg in his statement, Berhalter said that, you know, he talked with his family about it and Rosalind talked with her family about the incident shortly after it happened. Jay is Greg's older brother, a part of his family. So, you know, did Jay know about this and disclose it to US Soccer? Did he know about it and not talk about it to US Soccer? I mean, I would assume that US Soccer did not know, and that's why they launched an investigation when Ernie Stewart was told about the incident by Danielle Reyna. So that is something that raises an eyebrow for me. I mean, I think, Felipe, maybe you're going down the path of like this whole thing is pretty insular.
Yeah.
And we're talking primarily about two families here. And I think some of that is nothing to do with US Soccer and sort of coincidental. They hired a head coach who was a former player for the national team. That's something that is normal around the world. Gareth Southgate, Didier Deschamps. I'm missing many over time and over many years and over many countries. But
El Piojo.
Those are just
two
examples.
I'm going to bring him up, by the way. That's why I brought him up. But go ahead.
Those are just two examples right off the top of my head at this World Cup.
Yeah.
And so that's a normal thing. The son of one of his former national team teammates happens to be a very talented soccer player who was on the World Cup team. And then everything kind of unravels from there.
Yeah.
I don't think, you know, should Greg Berhalter not have called up Gio Reyna to the World Cup because he knows Claudio? Like, no. Like, Claudio shouldn't have behaved how he behaved after Gio wasn't playing. Like, and that's unfortunate. I don't put that on the Federation.
Like, but it is like too close for comfort, right? It's like if
Greg Berhalter isn't the coach.
Yeah, no, what are
you going to do about it? Like you're going to not hire Berhalter in 2018 because at that point, Gio Reyna, who's in the NYCFC Academy, might break through to the men's national team while Berhalter is head coach. Like, no, that's not going to be a disqualifying factor. Like, there might be other ones, and I'm sure many people listening to this will be screaming about how he shouldn't have been hired in the first place. But I'm guessing those people wouldn't be saying he shouldn't have been hired because he knew Gio Reyna from when Gio Reyna was a little boy.
Right.
Like no. So that part of it I don't put on the Federation. I mean, if you want to say the Jay Berhalter, Greg Berhalter connection at the time should have been disqualifying, or Jay Berhalter should have been, I can't remember. I know he wasn't like really involved in the process of hiring a head coach, according to the Federation. I believe there was like a wall put up between him and that process. He was a commercial side employee. I believe he was COO at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So according to them, he didn't have anything to do with it. I actually believe that. Like Greg Berhalter was one of the hottest American coaches in MLS at that time. It wasn't like the US was in position to go hire Pep Guardiola or Jose Mourinho. They had just missed a World Cup. They were coming off of a weird year with Dave Sarakin at the helm, sort of this purgatory that they were in. And it was an extremely young team, and the prospects didn't look amazing for 2022.
Yeah, like, we didn't know. We weren't, like, no one knew what
it wasn't,
this team really
it
was.
It wasn't a plum job.
No.
You know?
No. I mean, Tata wanted it,
yeah. And you can argue that they should have given it to Tata, right?
But I mean, then, if we're talking about hot MLS coaches, at the time it was Berhalter and Tata Martino, without a doubt.
Yeah. And Jesse Marsh, I think, had gone over to Europe at that point.
Right.
But
right.
Yeah. So yeah, it was those guys. And I don't know. I didn't have a problem with the hire at the time. I don't have a problem with the hire now. But I do think that things have probably run their course and it'd be best for all to move on.
Okay, well, excellent segue, because I do want to ask you while I have you on the show, is like, you know, what happens next? Like, it's not so much that obviously his contract is up, Greg Berhalter's contract is up. Right now there's an interim coach in Anthony Hudson.
And Colorado Rapids legend.
Former Colorado Rapids legend, who we all remember just going off.
That was his most notable moment.
It really was. Coach. What was that, 2018? 2018, 2019, I think?
19?
I think it was 2019.
Yeah.
Just, you know, yelling at reporters about how he doesn't get any help from Colorado ownership, no way to compete against teams like Atlanta United.
Colorado was like a top eight team in the league after that point, by the way,
yeah,
for the rest of the season.
But you know, who leads this team? And not, it's not like, oh, who's going to coach this team in 2026, because It's strange to say, but because there's no World Cup qualifying, you have laid this out in several stories already and on your podcast, it's almost like it feels so far away in a weird way, because we don't know what's going to happen in between other than the obvious regional championships like Nations League and CONCACAF Gold Cup. But who should be the team? Who should be the head coach? And yes, the big names that are floated out there, the rumors, Jose Mourinho, Pep Guardiola, Zinedine Zidane. And then you mentioned Jesse Marsh. I think he's always going to be a candidate. I bring up Jim Curtin, Hugo Perez. Like, what, Sam, what happens next? Like, who is going to be the next coach for the U.S. team?
I don't know. That's $1 million question. Maybe more than $1 million question. I'll lay out some of the factors at play. You mentioned the schedule stuff already. This isn't like an extremely attractive job in the near term. It's probably going to be kind of boring for the next at least year and a half. Now, if you get into the 2024 Copa America, that makes this a much more attractive proposition.
Big deal. Yeah.
But that's no sure thing. You know, like this has been like a pet peeve of mine. But for a while there, it felt like everyone was like, oh, we're in the Copa America in 2020. It's like, no, they're not.
There's no host nation yet.
Yeah, like that's not done. Like it might not happen. And if it doesn't, you're looking at Nations League and Gold Cup. And for the U23 team, Olympics over the next couple of years. And then, you know, once 2025 hits, well, all of a sudden you're ramping up to 2026 and this job becomes, all right, that's something I could want. Could they work out something with a high profile club coach where it's like a job share type of situation? Would they be willing to do that? My gut says no, that U.S. soccer will want a full time head coach. But at the same time, if you don't get into Copa America, I think it would be fine to sort of just have like a caretaker-esque manager for the next year or two and just kind of carry it forward and then try and go make a big splash hire in 2024, maybe the second half of that year.
So do you think Anthony Hudson is
magisterial.
This is not a magisterial situation. Let me read his quote from yesterday, by the way. Anthony Hudson in the U.S. men's national team availability, when asked about being in this position as interim head coach, he said, quote, It comes in very strange circumstances, difficult circumstances. It's a shame for everyone who was involved, players, staff, Greg, everyone is affected by it. It's not a nice situation. Is he, to your point, if that's one way to go, to just have a caretaker manager, which, by the way, it worked out really well for Argentina. Lionel Scaloni was a caretaker manager after Sampaoli crashed out.
Maybe the U.S. should hire Scaloni. What do you think?
Well, hey, his continuation with Argentina is up in the air, so maybe that's the big time hire. But can we say that Anthony Hudson is essentially trying out for this, like a more prominent interim role with these two games coming up?
I mean, perhaps. Like he's got an opportunity, right? I don't know that U.S. soccer is necessarily thinking of him in that way. But if he comes out in this camp and does a really good job, then maybe he can change how they think. Like he has an opportunity, and I know he's going to do everything that he can to make the best of it. Anthony Hudson's got an interesting story. He's been a national team head coach before with New Zealand. That was prior to when he came to Colorado. He had a really hard time in Colorado. But, you know, I think he's sort of rehabbed himself a little bit with the U.S. He obviously had that bad moment that you referenced in Atlanta. I learned a little bit more about him at the World Cup, and like, this is a guy that like volunteers at prisons, has is doing all kinds of things for like animal shelters.
Loves his dogs.
Anthony Hudson. Yeah. So he's kind of got an interesting story. He was born in Seattle. His dad was an England international. So, you know, kind of a globetrotting soccer life. And we'll see, you know, I don't know that he has much of a future with the national team. Maybe he could be an assistant for a full-time manager if they opt to go for somebody from abroad. But I don't think, you know, he's necessarily long for this post. But if they do go a route where it's, all right, caretaker for a while, and there shouldn't be any rush, Felipe, to make a hire, then we could see him around maybe for Nations League or even Gold Cup or Nations League Final Four in the summer. And one other thing here, these big name coaches, they cost big money.
A lot of money.
And U.S. soccer isn't always the most flush with cash. You know, they pay really well with the players and they have good facilities and they take care of them well, but they're also paying out millions in lawsuits right now. And that's something to keep in mind. So if they can, you know, if they're going to spend $8 million a year on a coach or something like that, then if they can save $8 million by making that a 2-year contract instead of a 3-year contract, then maybe that's something that they wouldn't be opposed to.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
It's interesting because I think I agree with you that this, I always felt maybe the cycle for Greg Berhalter, if this had never happened, the controversy with the Reynas, I still think that after this World Cup, it probably would have been better to move on. But I still placed him as, you know, the top candidate to continue at least for a couple more years before the 2026 World Cup. But sometimes when drama happens, federations are like, okay, we need to just wash our hands of this. We need to get as far away from this as possible. And I bring up what happened in Mexico in 2015 just because it really changed the trajectory of the national team.
Of course, you're referring to the time Piojo slapped a guy at the Philadelphia airport.
Yes, yeah. He punched a reporter in 2015. Miguel,
was it a punch or a slap? I always thought it was a slap.
I mean, it's reported as a punch. There's video. We can dissect it on another show.
But sounds like a good story. Maybe we should.
Honestly, yeah, especially because he's campaigning so hard to be back in the picture.
But he's literally been campaigning for that job since the moment that slap landed.
But what if Mexico do? And I know this because, speaking to sources throughout the last few years from 2019 up until now, over the years, one reason why Tata Martino was hired was because it was because of his professionalism in front of cameras. He was always going to steer away from this sort of controversy, these sort of scandals. Now, obviously, Tata Martino just, you know, he fell off a cliff with Mexico. But that was why they went in that direction. They understood that this is a guy that's not going to get us in trouble. Like Miguel Herrera, which he can't keep his mouth shut, and he's always he's always a headline. But it'll be interesting to see. That's why when Jose Mourinho was like brought up as a potential U.S. national team candidate, it's like, do you really want that? Do you want that smoke? Because there's a lot of smoke there. You ask Real Madrid fans, ask Chelsea, Inter Milan, anywhere you've been, anywhere he has been, it's going to be a lot of drama.
Well, I have one question for you regarding Mourinho.
Go ahead.
We know he got the tattoo of the UEFA Conference League trophy. Would he get a tattoo of like a Gold Cup or a CONCACAF Nations League trophy if he won that with the US?
Wouldn't put it past him. I wouldn't put it past him. Honestly, this guy is different. He's different. But yeah, let's talk about the January camp before we close out here. Like I said before, today is Wednesday. They will face Serbia tonight in Los Angeles. Both games are at the home of the LA Galaxy, Colombia on Saturday. Let me read another quote from Anthony Hudson when he was asked about like how this U.S. men's national team roster was constructed. You've talked about this on Allocation Disorder. You know plenty about January camp, the history there. This is not when the European players are brought in, but this is how Anthony Hudson described the selection process. He said, quote, young, high potentials, Olympic age players, dual nationals. And then he said that there were other dual nationals that they could not bring in because they're with their clubs. And then guys with World Cup experience. Then he followed that up by saying, identifying positions where they can add depth. You've discussed that on Allocation Disorder. You know, who is the standout player here that can actually be part of the next World Cup team? What, in your opinion, Sam, are the key positions where this team really needs depth?
Well, I think a number of players on this team could emerge as potential standouts. I mean, we don't know how development is going to go for some of these 20-year-olds who are on this team. In terms of guys that are headliners for me that could step into the full team, like tomorrow, Brandon Vasquez is number one. Like striker, we saw how that went at the World Cup. Josh Sargent did a fine job, I would say, in Qatar. But he's not the most clinical guy. He's a good athlete. He works really hard. But he's like one of those strikers that it's like he does all of the little things really well. But like when you need him to be at his best, sometimes he doesn't have the highest ceiling in the box. Vasquez, I'm not saying he's dissimilar to that, but it's a different profile than Sargent. And he's a guy that was really good last year for FC Cincinnati. So he would be number one for me. In terms of other guys, you know, John Tolkien, left back behind Anthony Robinson is certainly a position of need. So I think that he could have a little bit of a chance to emerge for sure. Aiden Morris is somebody that I've got an eye on. I think he's very talented. We saw him kind of star at MLS Cup in 2020.
Yeah.
And then he did his ACL.
Right. You know who he reminds me of? Is it Richie Williams? Is he the former
U.S. midfielder?
Yeah. Like from like
England Revolution assistant coach.
Yes.
Guy. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I remember when he was playing, like I could not stand him because
Aiden Morris is a lot bigger than Richie Williams.
I mean, because Richie Williams is like not big at all, but like that profile, like it's like the gnawing at your heels type of number six.
Right.
So that's different from
that's another Tyler position Adams's. Of need, though. Is kind of who's behind Adams at the number six. Exactly. You know, Kellen Acosta has been that guy, but he's up there in age, and I don't think anyone is super duper comfortable with him in a starting role there. So he's one. And then, you know, I don't know how much of a chance this guy has, but he's a player I've liked for a while, and another one who was kind of breaking through a bit with the national team and then suffered a bad ACL injury, but Eric Williamson with Portland Timbers. I think he could be, you know, he could challenge like Luca De La Torre, for instance, as a guy that could play one of those number eight roles. Of course, I'm talking about this like we're still using the 4-3-3 that Berhalter did. That, of course, could be very different. And then a couple other guys. I mean, I think everyone's interested in Alan Senora and Alejandro Zendejas. So I'm curious to see what they do. Zendejas will only be in camp for the Serbia game because he's playing with Club America and he's got to go back to Mexico to fulfill his club duties after Wednesday night.
And Anthony Hudson brought that up. He said he really threw a lot of flowers at Club America for how great they were in allowing Zendejas to come over, which is very interesting because Club America, let me tell you, like they, at the highest levels of that club, we're talking like Teve Azteca owners and things like that. They're very connected to the national team and they are very pro Mexico club. And Zendejas, before the World Cup, when all the controversy started and he apparently reportedly demanded to be part of the squad and Tata was like, get out of here with that. the Federation president, John DeLuisa, was like, this is a player that we want to keep. Like, we are being open and public about this, that this is a guy we want to play.
Yeah, they wanted to keep him so bad. They played him when they weren't allowed to.
Exactly. So interesting that Club America gave him that access to come and play for one game.
I have a question for you. Maybe Club America sees these transfer fees for U.S. national team
without
players.
Without a doubt.
Is like, well, maybe this wouldn't be a terrible thing for us if he breaks through with the Americans.
Yeah, and he's at, like, he's hitting his peak. I mean, he's in excellent form.
24, good age.
Yeah like a good player, a different type of player, like an inverted winger type, a lefty that can come inside, is fearless from outside the box, can really strike the ball, very creative. And obviously, yes, we know enough about him that he was a youth national team player with the U.S., friends with Christian Pulisic because they played together, all that. It'll be interesting to see how he plays in this friendly, which not a lot of stakes involved, but for him, plenty to play for. Alan Soñora, who you mentioned, I agree. Like last year, or actually, yeah, before the World Cup, I watched three games successively for Independiente and read plenty about him. And so let me describe him. First of all, he's another lefty. Does not impress you physically at all. But he, to me, is an all-around midfielder. He can play, you mentioned the eight position as being somewhat open. He can play as an eight, because to me, he's like a all-purpose number 10. He wants to be on the ball, but he's box-to-box too. And not that he's tackling guys, but he does not stop running. For Independiente, he was all over the pitch. Very technical, very silky at times, and simple. Just a simple, smart player that can get out of trouble easily. And the stamina is really impressive. I like him because in Argentina, he's very highly regarded. He's not like a player that they don't know about. He's a player that like excelled for one of the top clubs in the country and was given the 10 shirt at Independiente, which is a big, big deal. So this is a player that I think will stand out if he has the confidence in this type of game. Obviously, he's never played at this level, but the ability is there. So very interested to see that as well. Serbia, not to get too deep into their roster. This is a highly, heavily domestic-based roster. There are three MLS players, and obviously the standout is LA Galaxy striker Dejan
Petrovic was the best goalkeeper in the league Turner left.
Yeah. I wanted to bring that up, and you know plenty about him. Petrovic, I mean, this dude can play. This is a very good goalkeeper. And you know, you talk about exposure to possible scouts, international transfers. This is a big deal for him too. Like what do we know about Petrovic?
Not a ton, honestly, but you know, he was statistically, I think, the best goalkeeper in MLS from the moment he entered the lineup last year. He got in pretty early because Turner left pretty early and he was injured prior to leaving. Petrovic wasn't there for the entire time, but he did really, really well with New England. And I think it's a mark of his performance that the Revs didn't miss Matt Turner at all after he left.
Yeah, that's true. We all thought they would too.
Yeah, because he was the best, him and Andre Blake, right? If you take Andre Blake off the Union, they're probably going to miss him, right? But you take Matt Turner off the Revs, they didn't skip a beat in net. They dropped down from 21 to 22, but it wasn't because of that. So he's excellent. He's young. He's a guy that New England locked up to a longer-term contract, and I think one day will probably sell for a pretty significant profit.
23. I mean, this is like peak age. This is excellent age for him right now.
I mean, for a goalkeeper, he's a baby.
Yeah.
He's a guy that if he continues playing like he did last year, I wouldn't expect to be in MLS too much longer. Jovalich, he's a guy that I really like, Felipe.
Yeah, man. He plays.
I think Greg Vanney needs to figure out a way to get him and Chicharito on the field together. Because every time he comes in, I felt like last year, you know, I don't have his stats in front of me, but it felt like every time I watched the Galaxy last year, he would come on in the 75th minute and like score within 3 minutes of getting on the field.
A banger too.
Yeah. Like every time. Yeah. And so he's a guy that he was signed under a U22 contract. I think he's one of the success stories for that initiative so far in MLS. I'm curious to see if he's able to make a move back to Europe. I believe he was signed from Frankfurt, I want to say. Eintracht Frankfurt in 2021. So he's coming off a real strong year. And then Ranko Veselinovic as well, center back for the Whitecaps, is the other.
Oh, thank God you said that. I was going to struggle with that last night.
I should have made you do it. It's your show.
God, thank you. Thank you. I love Ranko as a first name. Like, that is a hardcore name. Love it.
It is.
Ranko, oof. That is like, that's the perfect name for a Serbian defender. And what do we know about Serbia? I saw them at the World Cup. I saw them play in the group stage against Brazil. Obviously, that was on paper a team that everyone was so excited about, just stacked on paper. A lot of great players for Serbia. And traditionally, Serbia is a team that just produces really technical players. I think what we'll see against the U.S., obviously, yes, it's a domestic-based team, but Serbia,
very young team as well.
A young team, yeah. The coach is very experienced. But how does Serbia play? This is what I saw at the World Cup and what we've seen in Europe. I mean, they're very, very technical, but they're very patient too. This is a patient culture with the ball. And that, I think, is going to be a contrast from what we'll see from the U.S., which should be a lot faster, should be a lot more direct.
Caffeinated. Yeah,
definitely. Definitely. Serbia is like very calculated. They want the ball. You're going to see a lot of like highly aesthetic football players like when they are on the ball. And then when they get into the final third, that's where they can do some damage. They're very good combining because they have such a high level of technical ability. But they're going to want to be in control. And I think it'll be an interesting test.
I think so. U.S. I'm not going to sit here and claim to know anything about these players on Serbia. No. I saw them at the World Cup as well against Switzerland. And that game was an attacking slugfest for 50 minutes. But Serbia, you know, to your point, in the final third were clinical at times.
They can do,
moving the ball really well. Dusan Tadic, Mitrovic, Vlahovic, Milinkovic, Savic. A lot of itches. And they were scratching.
They were scratching. Oh, God. Boom.
But what they were not doing was defending. They were shambolic, Felipe, in the back, really disorganized and quite sloppy against Switzerland in that game. But I don't know. It's kind of interesting. No one really thinks of Serbia, I think, or most American fans don't think of Serbia in the way that you just described them as these aesthetically pleasing players. But Red Star Belgrade is like people talk about the Ajax Academy. People should talk about Red Star Belgrade
Old Yugoslavia,
Croatia, Zagreb, like in the same sorts of ways. Those clubs produce, they're factories for talent.
Remember the Yugoslavian teams from the past were referred to as the European Brazilians. That's like how good those players were. The Serbs, I think, are a little bit more stoic and defensive in nature. Not defensive to your point, like where they're just defensive team. But this is a team that we want to brawl with you. But yes, they do control possession. They want the ball. They feel comfortable on the ball. And it'll be interesting just because of the two cultures clashing, you know, and two teams that, let's be honest, we're going to talk about Colombia here in a second. But this is these are big time tryouts for these players. Again, we don't know much about Serbia, but I'm sure these players are trying to break in. They're looking at the Euros. No, they're
Felipe,
looking at the Serbian
team.
Roster.
They're combined four caps for the entire Serbia roster. Yeah. So everyone's coming here to make really a first impression.
Right.
And actually the only guys that have caps are the MLS guys.
Look at that. Yep. Hey.
To Veselinovic and Petrovic with one each.
Go MLS.
They're all going to come here and they're going to try and put their stamp on it and try and get their debut. And try and not just get their debut, but make their debut in a way that means they have more caps down the line. So it's a big moment for these guys, just like it is for the U.S. players.
Agree. And so Saturday they take on my boys from Colombia, which this is also heavily domestic based, but not. I mean, there are some
a lot of MLSers, players. Man. A lot of MLSers.
Six MLS players, but there are some. There's one European, two European based players. And Frank Fabra, who's a left back who has been at Boca Juniors for a considerable amount of time, typically starts for Boca Juniors, and then young players. And Colombia is interesting too. These are players that are going to be very hungry. This is a team that did not qualify for the 2022 World Cup. They are in the midst of figuring out who is this next generation of players and the Nationals going to look like post James Rodriguez and that crew. They hired Nestor Lorenzo, who has no international head coaching experience. He was the top assistant for Nestor Pekerman during the 2014 and 2018 World Cup cycles for Colombia. So he knows the culture, he knows the players, he knows the process that worked, but a lot to prove for Nestor Lorenzo. And I'll just go over some of the highlights here. The goalkeepers, I think, are going to be unknown to the American public, but Alvaro Montero plays for Mi Junarios, a big dude. Big guy with a lot of potential, guys to take from MLS, Andres Reyes from New York Red Bulls, formerly of Inter Miami, Juan David Mosquera from Portland, from the Portland Timbers. Our other MLS guys are
Cucho Hernandez,
Chicho Arango from LAFC, Dylan Borrero from the Revolution, and Santiago Moreno from the Portland Timbers. So, like, the attack for Colombia is, like, pretty impressive. If you if we're just looking at, like,
Cucho Hernandez is really, really good.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be interested to see how Lorenzo lines up. Does he go with Chicho Arango, who is, you know, sort of that traditional striker? Do you give Cucho Hernandez the opportunity that he's been craving with the national team to start and to be sort of that focal point in the attack? And then Santiago Moreno, who you and I talk about a lot for the Portland Timbers. I knew him back when he was a teenager playing for America de Cali, the team that I support. Cool. This is a good player. This is a good player who I think has gotten very good. He's gotten better in MLS because he's been forced to be a little bit more of an all-way player, a box-to-box player. So interesting dynamic here with Colombia. What are your thoughts? Who I remember listening to your allocation tour, you said that they would be like a slight test. I was slighted, to say the least.
I didn't even, Felipe pointed this out to me. This is like the third time he said it to me now, and I didn't even remember saying
it. It hurt. Yeah,
I mean, what are my thoughts? This is going to be not just a slight test, but a big test for the U.S. backline defending some of these players. You know, looking at these defenders for the U.S., I don't know. Probably Long and Zimmerman, I would guess, will start at center back. So obviously they're experienced both on the World Cup team. Zimmerman played every minute or every second at the World Cup. So actually that's not true. He didn't start against Iran. But, you know, did well in Qatar and has played against big guys. But Cucho Hernandez gives problems to everybody in MLS, these two included. Arango gives problems to everybody in MLS, these two included.
Doesn't miss no, in front of
the and like you just said, you know, these guys, Moreno, for instance, they're a headache to deal with for any defender. And it's a young, inexperienced backline outside of Zimmerman and Long. So I think the U.S. will have some serious questions to answer there. I think Colombia will cause some problems going forward. And yeah, I think that's the main thing that I'm looking at. I don't know the Colombian defenders as well. If Andres Reyes is starting at center back, then I think there will be some opportunities.
Target him, yeah.
You know, like, he's got a fabulous athletic profile and he can do some really good things, but he's mistake prone as well. So, you know, if you have Vasquez up there against him or a different striker, like, I think you can pull him around and bring him out of position and exploit some spaces. So, yeah. You know, I think this has the potential to be kind of a fun game. Maybe back and forth.
I agree, because in the back line for Colombia is also just completely makeshift. Like, these are new guys other than Frank Faber, who has been
sort of like played, the US.
Yeah. You know, Frank Faber has played at the highest levels in Argentina, has played for World Cup qualifiers, has been part of the Colombia program for a long time.
Right?
Yeah. Andres Ginas, he's a sort of an up and coming central defender for Mi Junarios. I think he's going to play, like, to your point. Andres Reyes, like, there's a lot to like there, but can be targeted. Just for the listeners, if you want to see a silky player for Colombia, Daniel Ruiz, lefty from Mi Junarios, this is another guy that is on a lot of European scouts' radars. I wouldn't say linked to MLS, but this is the type of player that could come to MLS, play well, and move on. And then we've mentioned the players up front. I'll mention one more guy, Diego Valoyes, plays for Talleres in Argentina, heavily linked to MLS in my circles every time he's brought up. Also a tricky, silky dribbler. So, like, that's going to be interesting because Nestor Lorenzo for Colombia wants these guys to play. If you saw the team against Mexico that beat Mexico before the World Cup, they were very adventurous going forward. He likes his fullbacks to get high up the field. So to your point, Sam, I think that could be a fun game. We won't get into predictions because it's just too heavy to my heart. Anytime Colombia and the U.S. plays, I stress out. It can be the most meaningless friendly.
Even a January camp friendly, oh my God. You're going to be
stressed. It could be the most meaningless friendly between the US and Colombia, and my heart is just like divided. I'm stressing. Like, I know my friends are just waiting with their hands, their phones in their hands to text me, be like, haha, we beat you. So that's what I'm expecting.
On either side, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's a lose-lose for you, but also a win-win. It's the rare win-win, lose-lose.
True. True. That's what I'm saying. Like, it's a difficult moment for me when Colombia and the US play. Plus, like, I have major PTSD from USA 94. I can't just,
still,
that is, that
30 was, years yeah. on.
Oh, tragic. Tragic. Never forget. Sam, always a pleasure, man. Thanks for coming on. I'll see you when I see you.
yeah, you will. Felipe, thanks for having me, man. It was fun. You know, I'm a big Copa guy, as you know. So it's cool to be a part of the show.
Thanks, Sam.